The Israel-Hamas ceasefire has been delayed by at least a day.
The first fire will be 7 a.m. Friday, the 24th of November, and it will last, of course, as agreed, for 4 days.
How mines are threatening civilians in Ukraine's deoccupied regions.
The unprecedented contamination of Ukrainian land with mines and other explosives, depending on the resources, it can take decades for Ukraine to clean its land.
New research sheds light on anti-American propaganda that's online.
With the ongoing conflict with Hamas increasing and moving towards probably even more extremist tone, rhetoric.
And why the world has seen a surge in climate-related lawsuits. Today is Thursday, November 23rd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Miller. A ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war that was set to begin on Thursday has been delayed until at least Friday. But Qatar's foreign ministry spokesperson did speak to reporters on Thursday, giving a definitive time.
And the first fire will be 7 a.m. Friday, the 24th of November, and it will last, of course, as agreed, for 4 days. And the first patch of civilians to be released from Gaza will be around 4 p.m. of the same day.
Earlier, the prime ministers of Spain and Belgium met with Israel's ceremonial president in Jerusalem. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez expressed his solidarity with those suffering the consequences of the conflict.
And I welcome the agreement that will allow for the release of some of the hostages and the establishment of a humanitarian pause. We hope it is fully implemented as soon as possible.
Sanchez also proposed an international peace conference to forge a two-state solution. Israel and Hamas agreed to a deal to release 50 Israeli hostages, all of whom are women and children, in exchange for a 4-day pause in the fighting and the freedom for some 150 Palestinian prisoners. Israel and Hamas say that after the ceasefire, however, the fighting in Gaza will resume. Linda Gradstein now continues our coverage.
After weeks of efforts by Qatar, Egypt, and the U.S., Israel and Hamas agreed to a 4-day ceasefire in exchange for the release of 50 Israeli hostages, all women and children. Israel also agreed to release 150 Palestinian prisoners, all women and minors. Hamas will hand over 50 hostages in stages to the Red Cross, who will transfer them to Israeli soldiers. Israel says they will be brought to isolated medical facilities inside Israel to reunite with their families and have medical checks. Each day, another 12 or 13 hostages will be freed. Israeli press reports say this deal will initially include 30 children, 8 mothers, and 12 other women. Israel claims that Hamas is holding some 40 children, but Hamas says it cannot yet locate some 10 additional children kidnapped on October 7th. The Israeli cabinet approved the deal in a late-night session Tuesday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said,
"We are facing a difficult decision this evening, but it's a right decision. The entire security establishment fully supports it."
Israel has published a list of 300 Palestinian prisoners, either women or those under age 19, half of whom will be released in exchange for the 50 Israeli hostages. Others could be freed if the ceasefire is extended. One of those on the list is 18-year-old Ubay Abu Maria, whose father Yusuf was himself jailed by Israel 5 times. Yusuf says his son was first arrested at 14 and is now injured, losing control of 70% of his arm. He says, "I am very happy that Ubay will be in my arms."
Ubay was first arrested at 14 and he's now injured, losing control of 70% of his arm. "I am very happy that soon Ubay will be in my arms."
The war began after fighters from U.S.-designated terrorist group Hamas crossed into Israel October 7th and killed some 1,200 people, abducting another 240, mostly civilians. Israel responded with massive airstrikes and a ground invasion that has killed at least 14,000 people in Gaza, more than two-thirds of them women and children, according to Hamas. During the 4-day ceasefire, Israel will allow large quantities of humanitarian aid, including fuel, into Gaza. But Israeli officials say that after the ceasefire ends, Israel will resume its offensive against Hamas. Brigadier General Yaakov Amidror is a former head of Israel's National Security Council.
Unlike many Israelis, I believe that it is very clear to the decision makers that they cannot stop. The Israeli sentiment will not let them stop. If they stop the war after the 4, 5, 6 days of the ceasefire, that would be the end of this government.
For the families of the hostages in Israel, it is a time of unbearable tension as they wait to see if their loved ones will be freed. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
And in an exclusive interview on Wednesday, Israeli government spokesperson Eliane Levy spoke with VOA's Carol Van Dam about the 4-day pause in the fighting, but he begins by describing Israel's reaction to a recent satellite image over Gaza that researchers tell VOA shows that between 40 and 51% of the buildings in northern Gaza have been damaged or destroyed since the beginning of the war.
That really is a tragedy that for the last 16 years that the Hamas terror group has controlled the Gaza Strip, it has exploited the Strip and its residents to advance its goal of murdering Jews and destroying the state of Israel. Hamas even built whole hospitals on top of the terror tunnels that it had already built. All that cement over the years that was meant to go to people's houses went into Hamas's terror tunnels underneath the ground. And in this war, in response to the October 7th massacre, that horrific slaughter of 1,200 Israelis on October 7th, we have been targeting Hamas infrastructure. We've been targeting those tunnels and that terrorist infrastructure they built underneath civilian areas in the most inhumane way.
You have concrete evidence of that, that they
absolutely
built first and then they built the hospitals on top.
Indeed, the Israeli army has released satellite footage showing the construction of the Indonesian hospital, showing a Hamas command areas. And then a few years later, you see the same satellite images showing a building on top of it. The Shifa hospital, we all know now beyond doubt, was being used as a Hamas command center. Just this evening, the Israeli army has released footage from inside that tunnel network. First, we showed a 10-meter deep shaft leading to a 55-meter long tunnel in the hospital. Yesterday, we showed that we managed to get through the blast door at the end of that tunnel, and now we're in. And we've shown the air-conditioned rooms that Hamas was using and the bathrooms they had in these bunkers underneath the hospital in that terror network. And it is tragic that Hamas has subjugated the people of the Gaza Strip and used the Gaza Strip to advance that goal of terrorism and war against Israel.
What about my question? Does Israel plan to rebuild there?
Israel has three principles for the day after Hamas. First, demilitarization. Second, de-radicalization. We can't have a return of extremism. And third, reconstruction. Of course, we want to see houses being built again in the Gaza Strip, but we have to make sure this time that the concrete that goes in for people's houses actually goes to the houses and it doesn't go into building a whole underground city of tunnels like it has in recent years. We have to make sure that the water pipes that go into the Gaza Strip get used to transport water instead of getting dug up and sent as rockets back into Israel, because Hamas has actually released videos of them digging up water pipes and sending them back into Israel as rockets.
What can you tell us about the ceasefire, and what are you expecting to happen after the 4 days are over?
There is no ceasefire. The war continues. What we have now is a temporary cessation, a temporary 4-day pause in order to facilitate an evacuation of 50 hostages. The arrangement that we have now is to get 50 hostages, women and children. There is a baby who is only 10 months old, who has been held hostage by Hamas for nearly 50 days now. There's a 3-year-old girl who's been held hostage. She's an orphan because Hamas murdered her parents in front of her. And we're going to try to get those 50 women and children out. And then we're offering Hamas a choice. For every 10 additional hostages it releases, we will give another 1-day pause in the fighting. But after that is done, we will continue with all force to continue to put pressure on Hamas to release all of our 240 hostages. There will be no one left behind. And we will continue. This war will end with the end of Hamas, because otherwise we're going to find ourselves in the same cycle of violence with Hamas, which tells us it wants to perpetrate another October 7th massacre. And we won't let it. The October 7th massacre was a crime against humanity, not only against the Israeli people, but there are nationals of 26 countries who are being held hostage in the Gaza Strip right now. Nationals of over 42 countries who were either murdered, abducted, or injured on that terrible day. And we're doing everything we can to bring everyone home. Everyone. No one will be left behind.
Ilan Levy is an Israeli government spokesperson. He was speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says that more than 12,000 Palestinians, including at least 5,000 children, have been killed in Israel's military offensive in the Gaza Strip. And Dr. Muhammad Abu Salmiya, the director of the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, as well as some other medical staff, have been detained by the Israel Defense Forces. Now, the IDF claims the hospital's resources, including electricity, were extensively used by Hamas to support its underground infrastructure. The Israeli hostages were also held there, according to the allegations, and the hostage Noah Marciano was killed on the hospital's premises. However, VOA has not been able to independently verify any of the claims. As Ukraine's forces continue their counteroffensive, mines and explosives threaten the people in deoccupied regions. Demining efforts led by numerous entities are actively underway. And Miroslava Gongadze tells that story.
On Saturday morning, the mining crew in Balaklia, Ukraine's Kharkiv region, are getting ready to go to the field. Russian forces had occupied one-third of this region shortly after the start of the war. When they retreated months later, they left this land contaminated with mines. Such weapons have killed at least 264 civilians and injured more than 830 throughout Ukraine since Russia's full-scale invasion in February 2022. Emergency personnel here face an unprecedented test, says Anatoly Vrublevsky, the head of the Kharkiv region's demining directorate and overseer of 35 demining units. Rublevsky says that the biggest problem is that people are killed or injured daily. 30% of the oblast had been occupied, he says. After a counteroffensive operation, it was liberated, and now his team have very dangerous territory to work on. Rublevsky says international support is crucial to their work. Ukrainian deminers make use of all outside assistance, which includes demining machines, protective gear, and transportation. Here in Balaklia, emergency services detect a mine and conduct a controlled explosion. Back in Kyiv, the Ukrainian government coordinates the humanitarian demining effort, bringing together government stakeholders and international partners. Deputy Minister of Economy Igor Beskorovany oversees the initiative, which for him is personal. In 2016, he lost his leg to an anti-tank mine.
We won't return to use an 80% potentially contaminated area.
Beskorovany says Russia violated all norms and practices when it mined the territory, and this poses a significant challenge for the miners. Ukrainian specialists are working on techniques to scan potentially contaminated areas to create a database and map for future demining efforts.
We have a situation when territories that contamination have any logic. It's a huge problem because we can predict next step where, when we're working with still logic, but we can't predict the next step when we're working with situations that don't have any logic.
Last spring, the World Bank estimated that Ukraine would require $37.5 billion for the mining efforts. However, the need continues to evolve with the war and requires constant reevaluation. Lithuania is spearheading the European Union's demining efforts in Ukraine. Tomas Matulevičius, the economic attaché of the Lithuanian embassy in Ukraine, says the international coalition must do more.
It's not enough for the moment, but it's just the beginning. And in the future, we hope that it will be more tools, more methods, more financial instruments, and the more, I would say, funds or the government will join the coalition. It depends how much money it will be, how much specialists will be prepared here in Ukraine and abroad. So it depends from all us, and we need to do that together.
The unprecedented contamination of Ukrainian land with mines and other explosives, destroying ecosystem and undermining food security in Ukraine and the world, deepening the problem of hunger. Depending on the resources, it can take decades for Ukraine to clean its land, and it will rely on international community to assist with the demining effort. Мирослава Гонгадзе, VOA News, Балаклія, Kharkiv region, Ukraine.
And still to come,
our hopes and dreams and lives are being washed away by a flood of greenwashing and lies.
This is VOA News. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. New research is shedding light on Arabic anti-American propaganda that's online as the Israel-Hamas war continues. Earlier, I spoke with two of the authors of an upcoming paper detailing that study. Craig Albert is a professor as well as the director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies, and Ahmed Alaroud is an associate professor in the School of Computer and Cyber Sciences, both of whom are from Augusta University in Georgia. Craig Albert, let's begin with you. This is a research paper to be published shortly. From a broader perspective, you know, based on the research data that you and the team reviewed, you know, how widespread is anti-U.S. sentiment, you know, in Arab-speaking countries, you know, that you came across?
Well, what we're finding is that we definitely have widespread anti-American propaganda in some of these countries. The data right now that we looked at showed different spheres or different types of anti-American propaganda, depending on the themes that we were searching. What we can say is definitely with the ongoing conflict with Hamas increasing and moving towards probably even more extremist tone, rhetoric, and more themes that are looked to investigate in the near future.
Ahmed, how was the research conducted? Because the preview of the research paper that I saw mentioned that the research was predominantly conducted by Twitter, which is now known by X. But, you know, how was data collected, reviewed, and analyzed?
Basically, for this research, we rely on some pre-existing data that Twitter has classified as state-affiliated accounts. When we say state-affiliated, I should be careful here. Does that mean that the governments are sponsoring those Twitter accounts? It means that somehow those Twitter accounts were found to be sharing or tweeting content that support the agenda of certain governments. And for this paper, it was the Saudi Arabia. But in general, the data that we've got consists of tweets and accounts that passed between the periods of 2019 and 2022.
Now, Ahmed, you mentioned filtering the responses on Twitter, which is, of course, now known as X. The data was applied to the Bend Social Cybersecurity Framework. Can you briefly explain what that is?
Exactly. So this is a framework that was developed, created by Professor Kathleen Carley from Carnegie Mellon University. It is basically one of the most used social cybersecurity frameworks. You know, we know that cyber attacks nowadays happen through computer networks or mobile phones or smartphones or things like that. But recently there has been something called cognitive social cyber attacks, and those basically focus on human minds, attacking human minds. That is very common nowadays in social media with what we have of conspiracy theories, of disinformation, propaganda, even what's going on about the conflicts in the Middle East. But the Bend Social Cybersecurity Framework tried to explain what are the motivations.
Craig Albert, following up on that, you know, based on the research, you know, how are Arabic countries, at least the samples that you and Dr. Alaroud saw, you know, how are they framing U.S. policies and interactions in the Middle East?
Well, right now, it definitely looks like there's some type of exasperation at U.S. policies. There's definitely some framing of negative emotions coming from what the United States is doing overseas. And this is just a general swath that we have so far from these countries. And so what we're trying to do now is get more specific and look into further like media images, multimodal images, and see precisely, Steve, like the connection between what the U.S. is doing and what the resulting narratives are and why they have those narratives. And then once we have the exact reasoning or to the best of our ability through the processes, understanding what the narratives are and what the motivations are of these narratives, then we can craft more specific policies for the United States to counteract these narratives. But what we see is that anti-American propaganda, disinformation, and these general narratives of bad intentions by the United States, for instance, or just chaos in the United States, for instance, is definitely present in Arabic-speaking countries. And that's alarming to us because that means that this propaganda could spread. It could get more negative. Any type of hotspot that exists in Arab-speaking countries, for instance, in Israel and Hamas, could exacerbate these motivations, these actors, could spread rapidly, and could spread different types of propaganda that is deadlier or that could lead to calls for exciting the population, extremist population, for instance, to do something against the United States.
Craig Albert and Ahmed Alaroud are professors at Augusta University in Georgia, and we'll have more of our conversation on tomorrow's program. As global temperatures and emissions climb, people are increasingly turning to courtrooms. Reuters climate correspondent Gloria Dickey explains.
The world has seen a surge of climate lawsuits in the last 5 years. Nearly 2,500 cases have been filed in courts as activists seek to hold companies to account for climate change. Here are some of the key trends in climate litigation. Climate activists are zeroing in on climate washing or greenwashing claims, accusing companies of publishing misleading plans to rein in emissions.
Our hopes and dreams and lives are being washed away by a flood of greenwashing and lies.
Where once it was largely fossil fuel majors being sued, nowadays lawsuits are going after everyone, from airlines to oat milk companies. At the same time, companies are hitting back at governments and activists with so-called backlash cases. We've seen companies push back on moves to require companies to consider ESG, or environmental, social, or governance issues, in their investment decisions. Climate activists are also being targeted. Shell has filed a suit against Greenpeace seeking $2.1 million in damages after protesters in January boarded the company's oil production vessel near the Canary Islands. One of the most important cases to watch in 2024 is the case of a Peruvian farmer suing German energy utility RWE. The farmer says that RWE has contributed to climate change, which has melted the glacier near his home, posing the risk of dangerous floods. The case relies on attribution science. Can you prove that a company contributed to climate change, and to what extent? Another case to watch is six Portuguese youth suing 33 European governments for failing to avert catastrophic climate change, which they say threatens their right to life. The case is among the first to be heard by the European Court on Human Rights.
Today's case is about the young.
While it's unclear exactly how these cases will turn out, experts say that in the past, these lawsuits have led to stronger climate action.
Act now before it's too late.
Gloria Dickey of Reuters News. And that concludes today's program. There's, of course, more news 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone at VOA, we thank you for listening. And until tomorrow, I'm Steve Miller.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.